They're very small groups of people, so it is quite a shocking thing to hear.
I want to bring in Donald Trump now as we end near the end of the program. I mean, he's been criticized for not taking climate change seriously, and he has a record of making some bold tweets, and he's even claimed in one tweet that perhaps China is responsible for global warming as some sort of conspiracy against the US. Anthony, what do you make of Trump's environmental policies?
I mean, I just don't think he knows what he's talking about, really. He has access to a social media account which has possibly the biggest platform in the world right now, and he's able to say whatever he wants, whatever pops into his head at any time without listening to any advisors. And really, it just seems like he doesn't know anything that he's talking about, and everything is always an external enemy. He never does anything wrong. There's nothing wrong with the United States. You know, when it comes to Kim Jong-un and North Korea as well, it's them who are the aggressive ones with the missiles and everything like that. So it's always, there's someone else that's the problem, and it's he's never able to look inwards.
Amir, what would you say the ultimate message of this documentary is?
Well, that we should all turn vegan, really, if we want to save the planet.
So cutting out meat or eating less is not enough, apparently.
Apparently not.
To reverse the damage that has been caused. Well, I'm afraid it was a really great discussion, but we'll have to leave it there for now. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. And thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Camila Shambiati.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The UK is to host vital UN climate talks called COP26 in Glasgow next November, postponed by a year by the pandemic, at which all nations will be expected to come forward with national plans on emissions. Known as Nationally Determined Contributions, or NDCs, these plans for carbon curbs by 2030 are the bedrock of the 2015 Paris Agreement. As host, the UK will be expected to show purported leadership on its NDC in the hope of pushing other countries towards the tougher targets needed. Under current NDCs submitted in 2015, greenhouse gas emissions globally would reach levels giving rise to 3 degrees centigrade of heating, far in excess of the Paris upper limit of 2 degrees Celsius, and likely to cause devastating extreme weather. Lord Stern of Brentford, who is an advisor to the government on COP26, said recently that the UK government should submit a 70% emissions cutting target for its NDC. However, the government's target is likely to fall slightly below that figure at 68% to 69%, though it will still represent a hastening of effort. Current plans under the UK's carbon budgets would imply a cut of about 61% by 2030. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Fiona Harvey, an environment correspondent, under the heading UK's 2030 carbon target set to disappoint green campaigners. This article has been appeared on the front page of TheGuardian.com. Please stay tuned for more. Green campaigners and climate experts are set for disappointment as the UK government prepares to publish its carbon target for 2030. Environmental and development groups have been pushing the Prime Minister to opt for a stretching target of cutting emissions by 75% by 2030 compared with 1990 levels, which would have put the UK at the forefront of developed countries in fighting the climate crisis. The UK is to host vital UN climate talks called COP26 in Glasgow next November, postponed by a year by the pandemic, at which all nations will be expected to come forward with national plans on emissions. Known as nationally determined contributions or NDCs, these plans for carbon curbs by 2030 are the bedrock of the 2015 Paris Agreement. As host, the UK will be expected to show purported leadership on its NDC in the hope of pushing other countries towards the tougher targets needed. Under current NDCs submitted in 2015, greenhouse gas emissions globally would reach levels giving rise to 3 degrees centigrade of heating, far in excess of the Paris upper limit of 2 degrees centigrade, and likely to cause devastating extreme weather. Lord Stern of Brentford, who is an advisor to the government on COP26, told The Guardian recently that the UK government should submit a 70% emissions cutting target for its NDC. Stern said, "The Prime Minister now understands that this is a growth story, not a burden," adding, "but it does need strong investment and innovation. However, the government's target is likely to fall slightly below that figure, at 68% to 69%, though it will still represent a hastening of effort. Current plans under the UK's carbon budgets would imply a cut of about 61% by 2030. The increased effort is not likely to cost the UK more. The Committee on Climate Change, the government's statutory advisor, will report in coming days that the cost of reducing emissions have plunged in recent years. Green campaigners argue that the rapidly falling costs mean the government should go further and faster. Research by World Wildlife Fund, WWF, and the Imperial College found that a cut of 72% by 2030 was economically feasible. A group of climate and development charities wrote to the Prime Minister Boris Johnson recently calling for a 75% cut in emissions to show leadership at COP26. The signatories wrote, "Given the need for the UK to take on our fair share of global emissions reductions based on historic responsibility, we must move further and faster and commit to pursuing every opportunity to even exceed this target, as well as lead global efforts to close the gap to 1.5 degrees centigrade, the lower limit on global heating in the Paris Agreement." The government is likely to hail its new target as an improvement on current plans and a marked strengthening of the target that would have been expected if the UK was still part of the EU. Under the EU's plans, the UK's carbon cutting figure could have been as low as about 65%. The EU will continue to debate its NDC in near future, ahead of a climate ambition summit of world leaders to be hosted on December 12th by France and the UN to mark the 5th anniversary of the Paris Agreement. According to the Paris Agreement, all NDCs are supposed to be submitted by December 31st, but some countries are likely to miss the deadline. Pierre projected winner of 2020 U.S. presidential election, Joe Biden, has made clear his so-called commitment to rejoining the Paris Agreement when he takes office next January, and drawing up a new NDC will be one of his early tasks. Biden also purportedly supports setting the U.S. on a path to net zero emissions by 2050. China set a new target of net zero emissions by 2060, and with the EU, the UK, Japan, and many other developed countries now also aiming for net zero by 2050, the stage is set for a so-called global effort on a mid-century goal of a net zero economy. Climate Action Tracker calculated recently that these long-term commitments, if fulfilled, would lead to a rise in global temperatures of 2.1 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels, not far above the upper limit set in the Paris Agreement. However, the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres warned recently that while long-term targets were a major step forward, they needed to be backed up by shorter-term policies and actions. The NDC are seen as a vital stepping stone towards fulfilling the long-term targets on emissions, because carbon cutting needs to start now to prevent the further buildup of carbon in the atmosphere. Guterres delivered his starkest warning yet on the climate, saying humanity was at war with its own planet. He said, "Humanity is waging war on nature. This is suicidal. Nature always strikes back, and it is already doing so with growing force and fury. Biodiversity is collapsing. 1 million species are at risk of extinction. Ecosystems are disappearing before our eye," adding, "Human activities are at the root of our descent toward chaos, but that means human action can help to solve it."
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is part of a speech delivered on September 21st, 2020 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference with participants in ceremonies throughout the country to honor the veterans of the Sacred Defense Era. The meeting was held on the occasion of 40th anniversary of the Sacred Defense.
Another necessary task is to develop characters. Of course, some personalities are already famous. Personalities in the Army, in the Guards Corps, in the police force, and also a number of Basij soldiers who are not in the armed forces, but there are many personalities who are not well known. Many biographies are written by individuals who have no fame, and they are many, but they have achieved great feats. Important issues and events are ascribed to them. There should be commemoration ceremonies for personalities where individuals discuss their role. They should do research on them, and they should discuss the details of their life. The discussion about the defenders of the holy shrines, which I touched on, is really one of the most interesting subject matters in our era, as it is a very important event. Syrian, Lebanese, Iraqi, Iranian, and Afghani soldiers stood alongside one another in one single line and for one single goal. This is an astonishing event. It is one of the greatest phenomena of our time, which is another blessing of the Sacred Defense Era.
Your light and love, all I see. Nothing more I'd ever want to need. My protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
Well, my discussion is over. I only wish to add something about the issue of the coronavirus. You should not underestimate the coronavirus. When 150 compatriots are lost every day, is this a minor issue? Some people do not have a correct estimate and evaluation about this issue. Imagine that an airplane with 300 passengers crashes every 2 days and all of them die. Is this a minor incident? If we have 140, 150, 170 victims every day, is this a minor tragedy? The cure is in our own hands. Well, as you see, the officials in charge are really sacrificing themselves. Physicians, nurses, managers, and others are all working hard. Therefore, we should carry out our duties.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
The bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
More than three-quarters of California's population are now living under the harshest lockdowns in the United States, as COVID-19 cases hit record levels in the country's most populous state. Regional stay-at-home restrictions went into effect for nearly 23 million residents in Southern California, and 4.4 million residents in a large swathe of the Central Valley on Sunday night, as ordered by the California Governor Gavin Newsom. The orders take effect on a region-by-region basis when hospital intensive care unit beds in the region drop to below 15%. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian journalists Vivian Ho and Martin Pengelly. The piece is titled, Millions of Californians Put on the Strict COVID Lockdown. Stay with us for more of Vivian Ho and Martin Pengelly's article. More than three-quarters of California's population are now living under the harshest lockdowns in the United States, as COVID-19 cases hit record levels in the country's most populous state. Regional stay-at-home restrictions went into effect for nearly 23 million residents in Southern California and 4.4 million residents in a large swathe of the Central Valley on Sunday night, as ordered by California Governor Gavin Newsom. The orders take effect on a region-by-region basis when hospital intensive care unit beds in the region drop to below 15%. The Southern California region and the San Joaquin Valley region joined five counties in the San Francisco Bay Area region, where local leaders preemptively ordered its 6 million residents to enter lockdown starting at 10 p.m. on Sunday, 6th of December. "We cannot wait until after we have driven off the cliff to pull the emergency brake," said the Santa Clara County Health Officer, Dr. Sarah Cody. The restrictions, which require people to stay home and minimize contact with other households, will remain in place for at least 3 weeks, covering the Christmas holiday. All retail stores can stay open, although at 20% capacity, along with outside spaces such as parks and beaches, but restaurants and hair and nail salons and tattoo shops are required to close. California reported 24,735 positive cases in the last 24 hours, bringing the average to 21,924 cases of coronavirus infection a day. The state had a 10.5% 7-day positivity rate, meaning that in the past week, 1 in 10 Californians tested for coronavirus came back with positive results. California Governor Gavin Newsom noted that the rate of growth on the state's positivity rate was very, very acute. Just 30 days ago, the state's positivity rate was at 3.4%. Health officials believe the numbers will only get worse before they get better. "We know that those cases that potentially occurred around people's dinner tables, activities, plans, travel through Thanksgiving are going to show up right about now. We're going to be seeing that for many days to come," said Dr. Mark Galli, California's Secretary of Health and Human Services. Dr. Mark Galli added, "We believe that the level of transmission that we've been reporting so far will likely continue to go up sometime because of those activities." Across the United States, 101,487 people were being treated in hospital with COVID-19 on Sunday, 6th of December, according to the COVID Tracking Project, and an additional 1,138 deaths were recorded. California has recorded more than 1.3 million cases, setting a new daily record on Sunday, with 30,075. Hospitalizations have topped 10,000 in a 72% increase over the past 14 days, with more than 2,300 patients in intensive care unit care. The 11-county Southern California region, which includes Los Angeles and San Diego, had only 10.9% of intensive care unit beds available, the state reported on Monday, 7th of December. The figure was at 6.3% for the San Joaquin Valley, a dozen counties in the Central Valley and rural areas of the Sierra Nevada. Together, the two regions are home to more than half of California's 40 million population. "Surging cases and hospitalizations are not letting up," said Dr. Salvador Sandoval, the public health officer for the city of Merced. "I can't emphasize this enough. everyone must take personal steps to protect themselves and to protect others. The surge in cases has overrun the hospital capacities of more rural regions of California in particular, such as San Benito County, which is included in the San Joaquin Valley region and is under lockdown. "Our only hospital in San Benito County is completely full," said Dr. David Ghilarducci, the San Benito County Public Health Officer. Dr. Ghilarducci added, "This is an alarming situation that could get much worse. We can only get through this if we work together. Please follow our advice to keep yourself, your family, and your neighbors safe." Other regions of California, the Greater Sacramento, Northern California, and San Francisco Bay Area, range between 20% to 28% in capacity. But health officials in five of the San Francisco Bay Area's 11 counties adopted the state stay-at-home order for San Francisco, Santa Clara, Marin, Alameda, and Contra Costa counties, as well as the city of Berkeley, which has its own public health department, saying they could not afford to wait. "Our biggest fear all along, that we won't have a bed for you or your mother or your grandmother or grandfather when they get sick, is the reality we'll be facing unless we slow the spread of the virus," said London Breed, San Francisco's mayor. The San Francisco Bay Area order will last at least through to 4th of January, a week longer than the state timeline. The new shutdowns were a gut-wrenching move for small businesses. Michelle Saunders-James was in tears on Friday at the thought of closing down her Oakland nail salon just 5 weeks after reopening. "We wear face shields, we take temperatures, we do everything we are told to do so everyone feels safe, including our staff and our team," she told KGO-TV. "So I don't understand why it's not enough, and I'm terribly sad and afraid." "We know that these various restrictions are a hardship for people," Dr. Galley, California Secretary of Health and Human Services, said on Monday. "It's not what we expected at this time of the year, but we know some of them are required to make sure we get through the surge as quickly as possible, and in saving as many lives as possible and in preventing as many infections as we possibly can." Other states are also struggling. In Arizona on Saturday, the top public health official reported a near record of nearly 6,800 new coronavirus infections, telling people to wear face masks around anyone outside their household, even those you know and trust. "We must act as though anyone we are around may be infected," Dr. Kara Christ wrote on Twitter. On Sunday, 6th of December, Virginia reported a record number of cases for a second straight day with 3,880. Virginia has reported a total of 255,053 coronavirus cases with 4,200 deaths. Iowa saw an additional 35 deaths on Monday, 7th of December, continuing its high level of deaths during the pandemic. Despite the grim outlook, however, hope is on the horizon. A vaccine developed by Pfizer could be given emergency use approval this week. California Governor Gavin Newsom announced on Monday that California is preparing to receive more than 2 million doses of the vaccine in December. On Sunday, Dr. Moncef Slaoui, the chief scientific advisor to the federal Operation Warp Speed Vaccine Development Program, told CNN's State of the Union program that, in his opinion, the vaccine's effectiveness could last for many, many years, with older people and others more vulnerable requiring a booster every 3 to 5 years. Dr. Slaoui also said it was not known if vaccinated persons could spread the virus, and said There may be an initial indication on that sometime in February or March. Dr. Slowey added, the continuing unknowns made it important for people to remain cautious and take safeguards to protect themselves and others against COVID-19. Once 70 to 80% of the population was vaccinated, he said, the virus will go down. On NBC's Meet the Press program, the White House Coronavirus Response Coordinator, Dr. Deborah Birx, said, the vaccine's critical, but it's not going to save us from this current surge. Only we can save us from this current surge.
Debate.
The judge in the U.S. has ordered the U.S.'s intelligence agencies to acknowledge that they possess a tape recording of the 2018 assassination of Saudi Arabian journalist Jamal Khashoggi. The judge also instructed the Central Intelligence Agency, the CIA, an office of the Director of the National Intelligence, to explain why they are withholding the tape and a CIA report on the gruesome killing. In this debate, we will ask why these agencies are withholding the tape and why it would take this long for this judge to make this move. Also look at the timing of this announcement. Do stay with us for this debate. Let's bring in our guest to discuss this. Michael Springman, former U.S. diplomat in Saudi Arabia, joins us from Washington, D.C. We also have Said Mohsen Abbas, who's a journalist and political commentator, joining us from London. Welcome to you both. Said Mohsen Abbas, date of the assassination of Jamal Khashoggi, October 2nd of 2018. Today's date, December 9, more than 2 years after the date of the assassination. Why do you think it would take this long for this announcement to be made and for this move to be made, which would prompt them to make, obviously, an announcement that should have been made when the assassination took place and when they got that information?
Well, I think straight away, the American intelligence, first of all, knew perfectly well what was going on. They would have been perfectly aware that Jamal Khashoggi was on the target list, and indeed they would have been aware of his movements. And they obviously subsequently have engaged in a cover-up of absolutely outrageous proportions right from the outset of when the news was released. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo hand-delivered a plan to the Saudi royal families, helped the Crown Prince get away literally with murder. You know, he was engaged from a very early stage in damage limitation. You know, Middle East Eye and various other well-known, if you like, established journals, etc., and broadsheets across the American corporate media network themselves have been pointing fingers, and it's been an open discussion, really, that Pompeo devised this plot to help shield Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman from the fallout following the highly publicized murder. Pompeo discussed the plan with Saudi Arabia's king during a visit to the country's capital soon after, a couple of weeks after, I think, it happened, and they methodically went through this process of plausible deniability, and they worked out this thing, and they were actually quite blatant about it. And it's rooted in one fundamental thing. The US is tied to Saudi Arabia at the hip. The dollar, the US dollar, has floated on the back of Saudi oil control of prices, etc. It's also floated the US arms industry, because Saudi Arabia has bought $13 billion worth of arms for its war on Yemen, which again is totally backed and instigated, supported by their American allies. And these two factors, the arms industry, the oil resources that the Americans desperately need to fill their debt holes in their own economy necessitated that Donald Trump would do and say whatever was necessary to cover up the incompetence of the out-murder of Khashoggi by the Saudi establishment.
Okay, Michael Springman, we're looking at what the judge has instructed the two of the most important agencies in the U.S. to do, the Central Intelligence Agency and the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, to explain why they're withholding the tape and a CIA report also. I mean, aside from the fact that these agencies are supposed to uphold justice and the rule of law, what has withheld them from releasing this information, which is the tape and the report, and why is it that they have not released it even up to this point?
Well, there's a lot of reasons behind this. There are 9 exemptions to the Freedom of Information Act on which this George Soros Open Society initiative is filed. And you can start off with 1, national security, and then you can get into internal agency practices, which is probably a euphemism in this case for intelligence sources and methods, none of which might be disclosed. You can get the exemption for law enforcement operations and records and things like this. And then there's the exemption for privacy. You invade someone's privacy by disclosing some of this information. And of course, you've got most of the federal judges who have spent time in the Justice Department and learned the ways and means of withholding information, which is what justice does in many cases, especially in lawsuits dealing with the Freedom of Information Act. So I think that what they've done really is simply order the agencies and the Office of the Director of National Intelligence to give them an index, a Vaughn index, of what they're withholding and why. And then they go on from there. And of course, the Vaughn index is not necessarily disclosed to the general public. So we can foresee a fair amount of wrangling about what's there, what you're withholding, and why you're withholding it. Of course, in my case, when I tried to find out why I was fired by the State Department, my Freedom of Information Act lawsuit was sealed as a threat to national security. So the judges can do as they please, and they can take their time on this.
Okay, well, the last part I'd like to talk to you about, but obviously that should be left for another debate, I think. So we're going to leave that one there. Simo Sinabas, it was very interesting, if you recall, and I'm sure you remember, when the CIA did actually conclude that the Saudi Crown Prince had been responsible for the killing. So then you would think that, they must have had some information. I'm wondering if this tape was part of that. But then that is where it kind of stopped in terms of having something concrete or tangible when you have the Central Intelligence Agency coming out with that statement. Do you think that the stoppage happened in the form of the U.S. President Donald Trump?
I think Donald Trump was directly involved. There was a very quick response from the CIA after the murder, and they had concluded in a high-confidence assessment that the Crown Prince personally ordered the murder of the journalists. Now, the relationship of Donald Trump and the Crown Prince is well known, and the Trump administration saw the Crown Prince as a pivotal part of their policy in the Middle East. They certainly weren't going to jeopardize his stability there, and they went all out to protect him. I mean, even before the CIA's conclusion was made public, evidence released by the Turkish officials strongly suggested that the Saudi Crown Prince had a hand in Khashoggi's brutal murder. That evidence was starting to emerge right around the time Pompeo was visiting Saudi Arabia in those initial couple of weeks of the cover-up. He met the Crown Prince at that time, and after the visit, Pompeo urged patience. He urged patience and said that administration had pledged to give the Saudi regime more time to produce an explanation regarding Khashoggi's killing. Now, compare that to the way the Americans operate, for instance, with the Islamic Republic of Iran, or those people who don't play ball with them around the world. They don't need any excuse. They'll go off and commit extrajudicial murders and killings themselves. So let's not pick on the Saudis alone in this situation. Donald Trump has form in extrajudicial killing himself General Soleimani being the obvious example. Their partners, Israel, just done it again in Iran with Mr. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, I think, from the nuclear industry. So look, this is just normal practice. And for Trump to weigh in and back up his crucial partner is no surprise. And they carried that on right through their administration, right to the very last moment. Because there are obviously going to be things that are going to come out which damn and indict the whole system and the corrupt mechanism by which the American state basically operates its kind of rogue foreign policies. That's not going to stop anytime soon, but absolutely clear that Khashoggi outraged the whole world, yet look what's happened. They've managed to do a public relations hatchet job in terms of covering it up. You don't hear either their partners in Europe moaning or groaning about this, yet again, when it comes to the likes of the Islamic Republic of Iran or Hezbollah or people who are obviously fighting for their own independence in that region, the European Union, all of this gang of, if you like, what I call Anglo-Zionist, if you like, movement, are there to pick on that individual. Yet Saudi Arabia, he gets given nuclear information, nobody complains. That's what the Americans are doing. American corporate companies are now bolstering Saudi Arabia up as a potential nuclear power in that region. They get no pullback on the war in Yemen, as I said. They're allowed to operate with the likes, in producing the likes of ISIS and Al-Qaeda, to unleash on West Asia. This is a carte blanche license, like the Zionist regime, that the Americans allow their partners.
Well, Michael Springman, let's look at that famous interview that Donald Trump had with the veteran journalist Bob Woodward. I don't know if you recall that that interview, but this was just recent, maybe a couple months at this point. But in that interview, Donald Trump said that he protected Prince Salman from Congress, boasting, and his quote, what I'm going to quote is what he said. He said, "I saved his," I can't use the word that he used, but you can imagine what he did say. So, first of all, according to U.S. law, wouldn't that make Trump guilty if he knew that the Saudi Crown Prince had actually ordered this killing? Because according to Penal Code Section 31, titled Aiding and Abetting a Crime, if you help conceal a crime, in so many words, then you're also guilty of it. Not guilty of the crime, but you're guilty under the rule of law.
Well, yes, indeed, it would be, except that this is always ignored. Look at Barack Obama when he assassinated Anwar al-Awlaki and his son in Yemen by drone strike without any kind of judicial proceedings whatsoever. The president has carte blanche to do as he pleases, even though he is, as chief executive, charged with seeing that the laws of the United States are carefully obeyed. So I think it's basically the Americans are want to cultivate their relationship with Saudi Arabia. When I was there 20 years ago, 30 years ago now, one of the goals of the U.S. mission was to ensure that we get plenty of oil from the Saudis. And that was done in such a way as to never offend the Saudis in any way whatsoever. The Saudis were engaged in deals with individuals to sell drugs and alcohol and then raid the parties at which the drugs and alcohol were consumed. And you couldn't report this to the Americans living in our consulate district because that would offend the Saudis. And this is, not new policy. It's been going on for all the time. The United States has been involved with Saudi Arabia since the 1930s.
Well, Mohsen Abbas, right now, however, it's a new day. You have the current U.S. President, Donald Trump, perhaps to be on his way out. And you have a new administration, once confirmed, and if confirmed, headed by President-elect Joe Biden. You have Saudi Arabia and its oil exports to the U.S. to slump to one of its lowest points. So that kind of leaves the Saudi Crown Prince, at least on this issue, not to have someone who may support him at this point. We know how the president-elect feels about this, obviously very to have been very angered about what Saudi Arabia has done. Do you think the timing of this piece of news is somewhat coinciding Again, once confirmed with the incoming U.S. administration headed by Biden?
Well, it is a fact that Biden will subtly shift some of his emphasis. He'll, I think, try to look like he's a little bit harsher with Saudi Arabia. He'll try and give his allies some sort of security that they are willing to abide by some international rule of law, but I don't think it'll be anything substantial. I think deep down, nothing will change, and the Biden administration will also engage in perhaps not such an overt cover-up, but they certainly won't pursue the Saudi establishment in any way, shape or form, in my opinion. I mean, the fact was that it was such a blatant act of covering up that Trump himself offered a stinging indictment of the Saudi effort to silence that dissident journalist, calling the series of events that led to the Khashoggi's death the worst cover-up ever. He says the cover-up was one of the worst in the history of cover-ups. That was what Trump said from the Oval Office. And he said it's very simple, and he called the whole episode a total fiasco. So not only did he do the cover-up of the cover-up, he actually was more or less boasting about this fact. I mean, I don't think Biden will be as blatant and as outrageous as this. And I think this is what the Trump regime, in terms of foreign policy, has done. It's really, in many ways, helped the ordinary public to really see the U.S. Administration and foreign policy for what it is. But not for one moment can you imagine that Hillary Clinton or the likes of Biden or Obama were very much different. Again, Obama launched more wars in his period and has a greater track record of killing people in West Asia and the Middle East, and was equally supportive of relations with Saudi Arabia as Donald Trump. Donald Trump simply did it absolutely, overtly and in your face. And that, I don't think, is now going to change a great deal. They are desperate, the Americans, to keep whatever cash is left within the oil revenues of Saudi Arabia. They want that all to ultimately come into American coffers, whether it comes through just bonds that the Saudis invest in, whether it comes through oil revenue that goes that way, or whether it comes through any other means. Real estate, for instance, the Saudis have $3 trillion of investments in American real estate. So you can see the relationship is primarily about money, but it's also geopolitical, strategically important at the moment, because the clash with the resistance axis, the Islamic Republic of Iran, necessitates that Saudi Arabia is used as a base by the Israelis, by the Americans, in their ongoing, war of, if you like, terror on the Islamic Republic in that region.
Well, let's look at the consequences of this very special relationship, if we can, and how it may affect different arenas, Michael Springman. I mean, first of all, the Saudi Crown Prince, he hasn't been humbled by this. We're looking at the most eye-opening incident in which a lawsuit was filed in the U.S. court by Saad al-Jabri, who has claimed that there was an assassination attempt that took place in Canada, where he has fled 3 years ago. He says Mohammed bin Salman wanted him dead because he knew too much. So you have that repercussion, and then you have how Saudi Arabia is still emboldened by the Saudi war, as our guest there in London said, and even looking at other things that Saudi Arabia has done in terms of silencing dissent within the kingdom, and the list could go on and on in terms of other violations that Saudi Arabia commits. So doesn't the U.S. see that this is going to lead to consequential incidents for Saudi Arabia to be involved in without even looking back?
Oh, it does, but it certainly doesn't care. The U.S. government knows perfectly well the Saudis have been after dissidents around the world. I was once on Al Mayadeen talking with a Saudi prince exiled in Germany. The Saudis have kidnapped people from Europe and brought them back to Saudi Arabia, and they disappeared them. The Americans know it. The Americans don't care. The press doesn't do much about it. They focus on Khashoggi, but they do very little about the other people, about Wujing al-Haflul and other dissidents that have been kidnapped from the Emirates and other countries and brought to so-called Saudi justice in the kingdom, and then jailed. So it's not going to have much of a change until and unless some people put the feet of the American government to the fire. And And of course, the national news media won't do it because they're too dependent on government sources and too dependent on organizations like these huge defense contractors for advertising revenue. So they're going to huff and puff and expect it to blow over as it eventually will.
Okay. My final question to you, Say Mohsen Abbas. You know, when we take a look at the gruesome assassination and the way that it took place in terms of the dismemberment and perhaps using acid, etc., you have this cover-up that's happened. Okay, we know that. The bigger question here maybe should be asked about this relationship and whether there's a possibility that agencies like the CIA, like the National Intelligence Agencies in the U.S. actually help cover up the 9/11 attacks in terms of covering Saudi Arabia and its involvement. What do you think?
Well, absolutely. The bottom line is one would have to be absolutely naive to the most ridiculous proportions not to imagine that the covert deep state intelligence of MI6, CIA, Mossad was incapable of tracking what Saudis were up to. Being such a key ally, being such a key source of revenue and such an important partner, who really imagines that the CIA, etc., wouldn't have their paws all over Saudi intelligence and their operatives? The fact is they know everything that moves within Salman's own bedroom, I would imagine. And following Jamal Khashoggi's killing, on the point of what other, if you like, people have reported, other victims have reported the Saudi regimes attempted to lure them into their embassies even after Khashoggi was killed. It's that ridiculous. The Tiger Squad, the death squad that's named as the squad that actually assassinated even Khashoggi, again is implicated in this. You know, exiled Saudi activist Omar Abdulaziz vouches for this. An opposition Saudi scholar, Abdullah Al-Oud, son of Salman Al-Oud, who's actually in prison amongst 30,000 to 40,000 other political prisoners of conscience held by Saudi Arabia without any real due process or law. All of these people have been, of course, now putting in these claims that this Saudi intelligence goes around killing everybody. So yes, I would say the CIA, Mossad, etc., are hand in glove with these efforts.
Thank you very much for that, Say Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political commentator from London. And thank you, Michael Springman, former U.S. diplomat to Saudi Arabia, spoke to us from Washington, D.C. Thanks for tuning in to another edition of The Debate. From Mikhail Tavlin, the entire team in the capital, Tehran, is goodbye.